From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm Evan Dawson alongside Megan Meck. Hello there.
Hello. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. Let's open the conversation in an unlikely place, I should say. Iraqi Kurdistan. We sat down with Andrea Hickerson. She's a journalism professor at RIT. Last year, she spent 2 weeks as part of a human rights delegation in Iraqi Kurdistan. Andrea wrote a piece for the Democrat and Chronicle about that trip, and she focused on the impact of oil.
In this clip, you'll hear Andrea talking about how the oil companies would come in, remove the oil, and the small villages would be left with almost nothing. She's come to view oil as a human rights issue, not as a political issue, and she's concerned that President Trump has chosen ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to be the next Secretary of State. Let's listen.
The one village we visited where they were incredibly frustrated, they said they've not received the compensation that they were expecting. The oil companies destroyed the main road to the village and have closed it. So now the families that still live in that village have to go a back road. So it makes it longer to get to hospitals, longer to get to schools. They have dried many of the wells there, cut off the water supply, and they're concerned about the environmental effects of this. And even just going in, I saw a dozen oil trucks going out on the way out. And to kind of add insult to injury, a lot of this oil is going into Turkey, which does not treat Kurds very well. But this predates Donald Trump. And I think just, you know, what hit home for me is that I just come back, but then to see Tillerson in particular, who's head of an oil company, going in there where they were not practicing corporate social responsibility, which is something all these oil companies say they should be doing. So, for example, where I was talking about the roads and the schools being tarnished, that company had promised to compensate the villagers in that way, at least for
help rebuild the roads.
Yeah, exactly. Let them move on with life, but that had not happened.
And when you say they destroyed the roads, you mean the infrastructure, the heavy trucks, those kind of things?
Yes, exactly.
I want to listen to two of the statements Donald Trump has made about this. The first came from the summer of 2015, right around the time that he announced. He went on Bill O'Reilly's show on Fox News. And here is Donald Trump. He's talking about his view on what to do regarding oil in all Middle Eastern countries. What should we do? How should we handle this? And he was critical that the Obama administration had not successfully used oil as a tool to manipulate outcomes. Let's listen to what Donald Trump said then.
Take back the oil. Once you go over and take back that oil, they have nothing.
But how do you take
you
it
know
back?
Right, you have to go in. You have to
with
go in
with ground troops.
Well, you bomb the hell out of them, and then you encircle it, and then you go in, and you let Mobil go in, and you let our great oil companies go in. Sure. Once you take that oil, they have nothing left.
That's Donald Trump in the summer of 2015. Well, let's go to last night. Yes, last night, Donald Trump was at a dinner in Washington, D.C., and he was riffing and almost joking about Rex Tillerson, again, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who is the nominee to be the Secretary of State. And Trump had this to say about what Rex Tillerson has done, not only through these confirmation hearings, but in his own career.
Thank you all for being here. We have great respect for your countries. We have great respect for our world. We have a man that I wanted right from the beginning, Rex Tillerson, and these lights are bright, but he's around here someplace. Where's our Rex? Well, what a job. Miranda, thank you very much. Thanks, Rex. I think it's tougher than he thought. He figured, you know, he's led this charmed life. He goes into a country, takes the oil, goes into another country. It's tough dealing with these politicians, right?
I mean, he's laughing. He goes into a country, takes the oil, goes into another country, and the crowd laughs. Did you find that funny?
No. No, it's fascinating because, I mean, in the first clip that you played, he's talking about we should just go in there and take the oil. Well, we have. I mean, and we've allowed that, and a lot of American politicians have known about that, and there's reports detailing that. But this notion that that's what we should do and that's related to foreign policy is just something that I cannot relate to at all. If the Secretary of State is supposed to represent our national interests, but then also supposed to be our statesman to the world, I don't understand how just pillaging a company of its natural resources accomplishes statesmanship or says that we are, you know, the standard for human rights.
Next, we'll turn our attention to human trafficking. It's a very difficult subject to understand because it's essentially slavery, and it happens in our country. It happens in your town. It's real.
And Peggy Kern is an author who decided she wanted to write about the dangers and realities of sex trafficking, primarily of young girls. We're talking girls who are 12, 13, 14 years old being sold for sex. Kern rode along with police, studied the issue, and she wrote the book Little Peach. It's a fictional account, but it's based on young girls she encountered during her research.
The complex relationship between
between these girls and the pimp. You know, many of these girls call their pimps daddy. Right. And that's not a mistake. Many of them are, you know, sexual abuse victims. They're coming from homes that, you know, were struggling. The promise of love is one of the most powerful, and the promise of safety, and the promise of a path towards a life is one of the most, I mean, who among us, you know, doesn't deeply crave these things? It is the most human thing, you know, these are the most human things to crave. But initially, you know, Michelle in the book, when he tattoos her, which is a sign of his ownership, for her in that moment, it feels like she's finally a part of a family and that somebody wants her.
She's claimed by somebody mm-hmm. for the first time. That's right.
And that, I mean, who can fault this child for feeling that way? And especially when she has, A, come from a family that has struggles, that has sent her a message that she's undervalued. And I also really want to add the message that girls like Michelle, who grow up in low-income inner-city communities that are largely of color, they're growing up also in a societal environment that is telling them that they don't matter. Their schools are underfunded. Their police departments, as we are seeing city and city across the country, and the reports coming out by the Justice Department about the civil rights violations, these children do not have good relationships with their police departments either, which is another path that typically children are told to take, right? If you're in trouble, go to the police. Well, that's not always a safe option for young girls of color.
For adults as well, it's not a safe option.
And absolutely for adults as well. And, you know, another really important point I want to make about adult sex workers, you know, regardless of their path to prostitution, I think we need to think about what it means to be putting women in prison at all for what is a nonviolent crime, and putting women in the position of having to either prove their victimhood as trafficking victims mm-hmm. or then being called a prostitute and being incarcerated. In many ways, that is the definition of misogyny, that we either have to prove we're victims, and if we can't, then we are morally bankrupt women who do not deserve, who deserve punishment, right? I think we have to think about that.
This week, we also talked about food stamps, or the SNAP program. The New York Times ran a front-page story about food stamps, but the article was plagued by some factual inaccuracies. And critics say it painted an unfair picture of people in poverty. The article implied that people on food stamps are buying mostly soda and junk food. That's not true, and it turns out people on food stamps purchase roughly the same things as people who are not using SNAP. I should say, it's not true that that's most of what they purchase. We all drink too many sugary drinks, for example.
We explored the misperceptions with Leverett Copeland, who uses SNAP benefits to feed his family, and also Mitch Gruber, the chief program officer for FoodLink. This clip begins with Evan reading a listener's email about whether there's a demand for healthier food options for people in poverty.
Jim writes and says, I'm a retired sales rep who called on city retailers for more than 20 years. I saw quite a bit of junk food bought with SNAP and cash in the city stores over the years. The retailers carry junk food because there's the demand for it. They don't carry fresh food because of the lack of demand. Maybe better education and lower prices for fresh food would bring up the demand. That's from Jim. I'm going to start with Leverett Copeland. What do you think, Leverett?
I personally witnessed a vendor with a corner store manager, or the corner store owner. The corner store owner was always asking for healthy foods, and the vendor was pointing him towards the less healthy, or we can give you more of this, and giving them more deals for those sugary snacks and things, because they get a lot more commission, I could guess, off the things that they sell. He was asking for rice, or we don't have rice, or we have this rice, but I can sell you this honey bun and give you more of this. Those are the kind of deals that I heard purposely that day.
Okay, and from your perspective, there's a demand that people will buy
whatever's there. They will buy whatever's there. If I send my kids to the store and if it has healthy foods, they will buy healthy foods. My granddaughter will eat a candy bar as well as an apple if you give her the choice. But you have to give them that choice. If you go to the store, there's only candy bars. Of course, that's what we're going to buy. And that's what's been put in front of us because that's what the store owners have.
Mitch?
I have a real problem with the email that came in, because the key word there is demand. I mean, what Mike and Leverett and I have all been talking about is that the supply chain makes it a lot easier to sell unhealthy food. Certainly, the requirements of selling a Twinkie, which can sit on a shelf for about probably 15 years without it changing, is a lot easier than selling an apple, which you actually have to monitor and make sure there aren't fruit flies or anything associated with it. I don't believe for a second it's demand. And I have to say the curbside market is a really key indicator of that. We served last year well over 20,000 people on the curbside market. We made over $150,000 in sales, of which more than 30% were SNAP. And way more than 30% were people who have SNAP benefits, but 30% were with a SNAP card. There is no doubt in my mind that people, if given the opportunity to use their SNAP dollars in healthy food, will do it. And Leverett's the perfect example of that. When we started doing the farm stand at Conkey Corner, guess what? People started using their SNAP dollars in healthy food. But it's not demand. And pinning it on demand is the same thing the New York Times did. It villainizes the shopper, when in reality, the problem here is what's available for the shopper.
Let's end the week on the arts. There are questions about funding for the arts. President Trump is reportedly looking at deep cuts to the National Endowment for the Arts.
Well, the Community Design Center of Rochester is getting ready to launch their 2017 speaker series, and the first speaker is Gina Renzi. She's the executive director of the Rotunda in West Philadelphia. That's a converted Christian Science church that now hosts 300 events a year, concerts, spoken word, poetry, all kinds of stuff. And that space could have become a restaurant, could have been a shopping center, but the community chose art.
On the show, a caller told us that he's an artist, but occasionally he's been told that art has no real value. Here's how Gina Renzi responded to that idea.
I also understand when people talk about that, because we have so many issues. You know, here in Philly, and I know it's all around the country, you know, we have schools that are in crisis. We have people living below the poverty level. You know, we have all sorts of issues, so I get that. But I think that art has a place in all of that. And I think that if you look at what happens to schools and areas without art, you can see a big difference compared to places that do have art. And again, you know, you just have to kind of look at studies that have already talked about this and have been talking about this for ages. And you also have to look at some big cities around the world and you know, not even such big cities, but places where there are huge advocates and have turned things that weren't necessarily considered art into art. One that I just want to plug very quickly is the Mural Arts Program of Philadelphia. It started simply as a way to cover up graffiti, unwanted graffiti on buildings, and it's turned into a city office that employs over 300 artists over the course of a year, and they create murals, they work in prisons and schools, they have all sorts of after-school programs, and it's now an integral part of the way the city addresses art.
You can hear Renzi's presentation on how to use art to revitalize neighborhoods. That's Wednesday night at the Gleason Works Auditorium in Rochester.
And that's Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can join us for Connections every weekday afternoon on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend.